Welcome to 40A&M in 5, a download of 40A&M LLC, recorded at 2100 Eastern on Sunday, September 15th. For more information and for our terms of use, please visit 40A-M.com. I'm Chris Bohm, and this is our weekly selection of tech sector and related global news and policy highlights from the past week. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit hears arguments on net neutrality. Billionaire investor Carl Icahn decides to no longer block Michael Dell's bid to take Bell private. Verizon issues new bonds, the largest offering in history. Canada's telecom regulator issues new rules on mobile contract lengths and collects data on mobile roaming charges. And the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit refuses a motion to dismiss from Google. And the District Court of New Jersey holds that non-public Facebook wall posts are protected under the Federal Stored Communications Act. UK communications regulator Ofcom issues its fourth report on online copyright infringements. And big data, a critical tool in a brave new world. When it works, when it doesn't, and where are we going? And we finish out today with our roundup of select international calendar events for the coming week. But first, Apple unveiled new iPhones last week. One, the iPhone 5S, will include Touch ID, a fingerprint-driven security lock rather than a passcode, as well as a new 64-bit processor called the A7, which Apple says will be up to twice as fast as the A6 in the current iPhone 5. The 16-gig version of the 5S will sell for $199, with a 32-gig version for $299 and the 64-gig version for $399. The iPhone 5C, which seems to have been aimed partly at the overseas market, which has long looked for a cheaper Apple alternative, will largely be the same as the existing iPhone 5, but will be available in a suite of new colors for a 16-gig version at $99, a 32-gig version at $199. Both new iPhones will release on September 20th, and also, as of September 18th, Apple's new iOS 7 operating system will be available for free download to all devices iPhone 4 or above. Last Monday, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit seemed to be expressing skepticism regarding the Federal Communication Commission's net neutrality internet access rules, which were promulgated in 2010. Verizon had sued the FCC soon after the rules were created, and in 2 hours of oral arguments, the court grilled the FCC and Verizon lawyer on the rules, which largely discouraged the creation of separate lanes on the internet for websites and providers willing to pay more for faster or increased quality delivery of their content into homes. The rules also bar cable and telecom carriers from blocking any websites, even if the site content competes with its own services. Verizon's attorney argued that, but for these rules, telecom carriers and cable companies could pursue business arrangements that could give customers faster and better quality services at different rate structures, but the rules would presently prevent that. At present, the FCC's net neutrality rules do not apply at all to mobile services, although the Commission reserves the right in the rules to extend them there. In 2007, customers had accused Comcast of throttling or purposefully slowing down the downloads of certain customers, and Comcast and others argued that they needed to discriminate between the bits of information being shared given the scarcity of bandwidth available to a growing number of internet users. The FCC cited Comcast, and the momentum for the current rules largely took speed from that event. Verizon's attorney argued last Monday that in 6 years, the FCC has documented only 4 examples of an ISP blocking content. In addition to arguing the FCC did not have the authority under the Communications Act to issue the rules regarding the internet that it did in 2010, Verizon's attorney also argued a First Amendment claim that its constitutional rights were violated by stripping it of control of the transmission of speech on its networks. According to NPR's story on the case, advocates of net neutrality fear that if the government stops enforcing the current rules, then certain companies will be able to have greater access to internet users, creating a system of haves and have-nots, because the pipelines would no longer be free and open. The same advocates also claim that to gut the rules would give ISPs a free pass to start making decisions about the information aspects of their service, from TV to doctor's visits. According to the Washington Post, which reported on the arguments, some analysts predict that the three-judge panel may weaken some portions of the rules, but keep others that prevent the outright blocking of websites. The same analysts cited that the judges will likely take months to issue a final decision, but that their questions and comments seem to be largely favorable to the telecom carriers and the cable companies. Among the major corporate events this past week, billionaire investor Carl Icahn announced that he was abandoning efforts to stop computer maker Michael Dell from taking Dell private. Without further opposition, it looks like the founder, Michael Dell, may now win shareholder backing for his $24.8 billion buyout of the PC company. Mr. Icahn had previously argued that the bid by Mr. Dell and Silver Lake undervalued the company. The bid includes an offer of $13.75 per share, plus a 13-cent dividend, and Dell has pledged to shift the company business away from PCs and into mobile devices and business software. Also last week, Verizon raised $49 billion in the largest corporate bond sale in history, dwarfing the previous record of $17 billion in bonds by Apple in April. The sale will assist Verizon's purchase of the rest of its U.S. wireless business from partner Vodafone, according to the Associated Press. The debt will come due at eight different times, from 3 to 30 years, and the demand for the debt was high, according to the Associated Press, with $11 billion of the new 10-year notes given at a yield of 5.19%. Financial Post writer Christine Dobby reported last week that Canada's telecom regulator, the CRTC, has introduced a new set of rules for the wireless industry that will limit the amount of time a wireless contract can be extended in order to amortize a subsidized handset. Such contracts will now need to be 2 years or less. Also reported, when the Canadian Radio, Television, and Telecommunications Commission's new rules take effect in December, it will also set a $100 cap on roaming charges. The CRTC has not revealed any plans to actively regulate roaming rates, whether at the wholesale or the retail level, although the regulator did affirm that it presently has the authority to do it if it feels that there is a market failure, according to the Financial Post. At present, the regulator has set a date of September 27th, a deadline for carriers to provide information on the wholesale rates that they pay. And according to the Financial Post, any next steps will depend on what the commission learns. Two court cases of interest were reported last week relating to privacy issues. In one, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit ruled against Google concerning the company's collection of Wi-Fi information in connection with its Street View service. Google had collected data from unencrypted Wi-Fi networks as it drove around taking photos for its Street View program. Data that included the network's name, the router's MAC address, signal strength, and whether the network was encrypted. But it also included payload data, such as emails, usernames, passwords, videos, and documents, according to Evan Brown of the Information Law Group. Individuals impacted had filed suit against Google for a violation of the U.S. Wiretap Act and various state wiretap statutes. And while the Wiretap Act prohibits the unauthorized interception of electronic communications, it provides exception to liability for intercepting radio communications or communications that are readily accessible to the public. Google attempted to have the claims dismissed, but the Ninth Circuit held that the unencrypted Wi-Fi data was not a radio communication in the meaning of the statute. And further, the fact that the Wi-Fi data might have been unencrypted did not mean that it was readily accessible to the public, and therefore exempted liability from intercepting it in violation of the Wiretap Act. The court observed that even unencrypted Wi-Fi payload data requires somewhat sophisticated hardware and software, which hardly makes the intercepted stream public. In a separate case reported on by Huntington Williams in its Employment and Labor Perspectives blog, in the U.S. District Court for the District of New Jersey, the court held that non-public Facebook wall posts are protected under the Federal Stored Communications Act. In Ailing v. Monmouth Ocean Hospital, an employee of the hospital passed on to her employer a wall post that a Facebook friend had made public to her about an incident at the hospital. That Facebook friend, also an employee, was penalized for the post. The District Court in New Jersey found that because the hospital employee had been given access to the non-public wall post made by her friend, who was also an employee of the hospital could not be penalized under the Stored Communications Act for taking action in view of the posting. However, in finding that the circumstances and relationships between the parties gave an exception here, the court also found that non-public Facebook posts are generally protected under the Act. On September 11th, Ofcom, the UK communications regulator, published its fourth survey of online copyright infringement. The studies have been commissioned by Ofcom and undertaken by Kantar Media, with financial support from the UK Intellectual Property Office. The study looks at six main types of online content: music, film, TV programs, books, video games, and computer software. The results of the survey, taken in the first quarter of 2013, estimate that 1 in 6, or 17% of users surveyed, age 12 and above, consumed at least one item of illegal content online, while only a quarter of these, or 4% in total, professed to be consuming exclusively illegal online content. The levels of infringement varied significantly by content type, with 9% consuming some music illegally, 6% for films or TV programs, and 3 and 2% respectively for computer software and games. The top three factors that copyright infringers said would encourage them to stop their behavior included 32% who wanted the availability of cheaper legal content, 27% who said that sometimes they want what they want is simply not available legally, and 24% who wanted clarity as to what was legal and what was not, citing that they weren't always sure that what they were doing was infringing behavior. Axiom, one of the biggest data brokers in the business, claims to have a database that holds information including one's age, marital status, education level, political leanings, hobbies, and income level on 190 million individuals. Major competitors like Datalogix and CoreLogic tout similarly vast databases, according to CNN's Smart Money. In most cases, all that is needed to match the information these data brokers compile with what you buy is your full name, obtained when you swipe a credit card, and a zip code, according to data privacy experts reported on by CNN's Smart Money. This allows them to figure out that you are Joe Carroll, who lives in Chicago, Illinois, and not the one who lives in Tucson, for example. Once a retailer identifies you, it can track and analyze your spending behaviors and background in order to predict what you might buy next. And in the data world, this is often called predictive analysis or predictive modeling. In July, we reported on a story involving a predictive analysis that involved the retailer Target. Target had discovered fairly quickly that, when made so obvious that Target knew about their pregnancy, in the words of a Forbes reporter, it creeped customers out. What Target learned, and what other retailers are also learning, if attentive to their brand reputation in the context of targeted advertising, is that even when something may be perfectly legal and statistically possible, is it the right thing to do? Or even if it may be the right thing to do, at its core, is there a right way and wrong way to do it? Of course, you typically don't have to give your zip code to a cashier. Last month, the Massachusetts Supreme Court ruled that zip codes are personal information under the state consumer privacy laws, after a customer had sued the craft store Michaels for using her zip code to find her and Sam's store mailings. She had thought the zip code was required to complete her credit card transaction, according to the suit. Now retailers in the state can't ask for your zip code for marketing purposes at all, joining California, which had a similar case. Currently, data brokers are required by federal law to maintain the privacy of a consumer's data only if it is used for credit, employment, insurance, or housing. Medical records and prescription purchases are off limits, but data brokers are allowed to track purchases of over-the-counter drugs and other related medical items. This has allowed Axiom to create a health interest category, which highlights consumers with interests related to health conditions such as arthritis and diabetes. In a letter to Congress, Axiom officials noted that they do not collect data about sensitive health conditions such as sexually transmitted diseases. But what is sensitive data? In the European Union, for instance, if it involves a health issue, it's sensitive, full stop. Here, Axiom equates the sensitive to a particular affliction. What measure is right, the fully restrictive definition, or the narrow target fixed by an industry? From target mining shopper data to figure out who is getting pregnant to Google using online search to predict incidences of the flu, companies and organizations are using troves of information to spot trends, combat crime, and prevent disease. Online and offline actions are being tracked, aggregated, and analyzed. Jonah Berger, Wharton professor and author of a blog on big data published by LinkedIn over a week ago, pointed out that while big data gets all of the attention, innovative technologies also have enabled little data to flourish. Personal quantification. Why do people obsess over LinkedIn connections or Twitter followers? SAT scores, golf handicaps, or even gas mileage, he asks. Because they are observable metrics that are easy to compare. Someone who has more LinkedIn connections must have more expertise. More Twitter followers? More influential, right? So the people who use metrics as a yardstick find an easy way to assess whether they are doing well. But as Professor Berger points out, just because a metric is easy to capture doesn't mean it's the right one to use. More followers doesn't actually mean more influence, support, or even friends. It may just mean that you spend a lot of time on the site, and others do too. He makes the analogy to education. Tracking student test scores helps measure achievement, but it also encourages teachers to teach to the test. Ken Kukier and Victor Mayer Schoenberger writes on their most recent book on big data that causality is nice when you can get it. But the problem is that it's often hard to get, and even when we think we've found it, we're often deluding ourselves. Seeing causality where it truly doesn't exist in any real or even slightly credible form is a real downside of over-reliance on what some might consider big data. For instance, there is an increasing value in data exhaust, or the data that is shed as a byproduct of action or inaction. But most that see the value in measuring a negative, i.e. I didn't press X or opt out, would tell you that to assign any direct meaning to the inaction is almost never correct. The authors caution that big data is likely to provide the temptation to judge on the basis of propensity, a temptation that society must be careful to squelch. If clearly it's worth doing well. Omer Tenney wrote for the International Association of Privacy Professionals last month that big data, powerful new ways to collect, analyze, and store massive amounts of information, can exceed the realm of national security or even government usage and extend to areas such as scientific research, public health, and energy conservation by the private sector. It calls for choices to be made between weighty policy concerns such as medical research, urban planning, and efficient uses of resources on the one hand, and individuals' right to privacy, fairness, equality, and freedom of speech on the other. As Omer Tenney wrote, even where privacy constitutes a fundamental human right, it may not be a value that trumps every other social consideration. But perhaps we can take strategic hints from an NPR story this week about how the Amish in America decide whether to take up technology. The difference between the Amish and most Americans, according to the piece, is that the deliberation that takes place before deciding whether to embrace a new technology. Many Americans assume that new is always better or inherently good. The Amish are more thoughtful, even suspicious, wondering whether X is going to be helpful, bolster life, or simply be a drag on community. In the end, the Amish are, as a whole, far more restrictive than even the most conservative average American with regard to technology take-up. But when considering how to answer questions attendant to the take-up of big data and related policy, an Amish motto with regard to tech take-up may be helpful. You shouldn't be the first in your neighborhood to jump on the wagon, but neither should you want to be the last. And now here is our list of calendar items for the coming week. This week, from September 16th through the 18th, European Parliament committee meetings will be taking place in Brussels. On Wednesday, September 18th, the European Commission will be holding a conference on e-procurement and e-invoicing at the Centre Albert Brochet in Brussels. Also on Wednesday, the Governing Council of the European Central Bank will be meeting in Frankfurt. And on Wednesday and Thursday of this week, the European Economic and Social Committee will be meeting in plenary session at the Charlemagne Building in Brussels. In the U.S. Senate, the Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation will hold a hearing on Wednesday afternoon in the Russell Senate Office Building on the nomination of Michael O'Reilly to be a commissioner in the FCC, as well as Terrell McSweeney to be a commissioner in the FTC. The FCC announced last week that it will host a technology forum on cybersecurity awareness, focusing on protecting children from online risks on October 1st. Watch for more information about that event. You have been listening to 48 MN5, a production of 48 MN LLC. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40a-m.com. All stories for this week's podcast were reported by at least two online or print news sources, or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from The Financial Post, International Association of Privacy Professionals, National Public Radio, The Washington Post, Forbes, and The Guardian. Next week, we will have our story for you on the road ahead for cybersecurity strategy and best practices internationally. As always, thank you for joining us. We will be back with you on Monday, September 23rd. Until then, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.